Good morning. You're watching Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. It's Thursday, April 16th. Good morning, Jamarl.
What's going on, man? How you doing this morning?
I'm doing pretty good. Looking forward to our guest. It's not every day that you talk about the ancient Canaanite god Baal with an expert on ancient religions. So joining us will be Dr. Daniel E. Fleming of NYU. He's an Assyriologist, okay? So he sounds like a dum-dum. Went to some school called Harvard, whatever. Anyway, he's joining us at 9:30, 29 minutes from now. Looking forward to that. Please like, follow, and share the show. We will take your questions for Dr. Fleming as well as for ourselves. In the live feed on Rumble and on YouTube in the 9 o'clock hour. If you're watching live, if you're watching later on streaming, thank you so very much. And there are ways to actually get us questions if you're watching in the streaming. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on with Robbie. He can walk you through that. Our lead story today, although probably not the most important, but a funny one, is that immigration advisors in the UK are basically asking straight Pakistanis and Bangladeshis to pass themselves off as gay in order to be able to get political asylum in Great Britain, and it's working. What? It's a scam. Yeah, it's a crazy scam. The serious news of the story, besides Baal, is there's ceasefire talks that seem to be going pretty well between Israel and Lebanon. So that's some good news. But you know, will anything come of it? Probably not, because no one's talking to Hezbollah, and you know, they're one of the main combatants here. You might remember that the Supreme Court declared a lot of Trump's tariffs to be illegal. So the good news for businesses who got dinged to a total of $175 billion with a B dollars is that they can apply to get some of their money back. Bad news is it's going to be complicated and the burden is on them. It's so governmental. And finally, Google has promised not to release any information to law enforcement officials or places like ICE without first notifying you so that you can fight that request. Well, turns out they're breaking that promise. So you may very well be that your personal data is being turned over by Google to ICE and other fascist government agencies. So that's basically it. Again, post your questions. Let's get to it. I always, Jamarl, why don't you choose what we talk about first? What do you
do? Lebanon. Because okay. I don't think it's a positive, personally. Because okay. What you're dealing with effectively is a passive Lebanese government that hasn't fired a shot in anger at an Israeli aggression that has been taking place continuously, remorselessly, inexorably, taking over aspects of Lebanon to create greater Israel. And so what you're getting is a U.S. government that is trying to use the Lebanese government to create a civil war scenario in Lebanon. And they've been doing this. I mean, Tom Barrett, the envoy, I believe he was either Syrian envoy, Lebanese envoy, he was very explicit about in an interview, basically saying this is what we were trying to do. And so it's not like, because two things are happening right now. One, the negotiations-ish between the U.S. And Iran saying whatever we come up with is linked to any kind of deal that we come up with, meaning Lebanon is linked to us. These things cannot be disambiguated from one another. Now, are they telling the truth? Who knows, right? You may get to a point where they toss Lebanon over the side for some kind of sweetness in negotiations. By the same token, they may also be right. And if they are right, then the negotiations taking place between Lebanon and the United States are pointless, or Lebanon and Israel are irrelevant. Reality of it is, it's not like the Lebanese government is going to do anything that's going to contradict Israel per se. By the same token, what is taking place in regards to Iran and those negotiations may supersede whatever takes place between Lebanon and Israel. It's interesting. Give me your take on it. I mean, is there anything you disagree with me on?
No, not at all. I agree with you. I mean, I kind of wonder what this is all about, right? I mean, so if there was no such thing as Hezbollah and no such thing as Iran, this would all sound very hopeful. You know, you'd have, okay, well, you know, Israel and Lebanon, its neighbor, both sides agree that they want a well-defined border between Israel and Lebanon. Of course, Lebanon isn't the issue here. This is the Israeli. Yeah. Israelis cross that border all the time, and basically they look like they're on the verge of annexing Lebanon all the way up to and maybe past the Litani River. And then the other, I mean, this reminds me a lot of the days after, the months after the overthrow of the Taliban in 2001, when the U.S. Decided to let the Afghans meet for a loya jirga and choose their new post-Taliban government. And all political parties were allowed to participate except the Taliban, who had the biggest number of supporters in the country. That didn't work out great. And this is sort of like that. I mean, Hezbollah is the most potent political force in Lebanon, and they're backed by Iran, and they're more militant than ever, arguably, than they're now fully engaged as a combatant, as a sort of distant ally of Iran. And so, you know, I don't know what the purpose of this is. One thing that Israel and Lebanon both say is that the two both countries would like to quote unquote expel Hezbollah. Well, I mean, that's like saying you're going to expel, I don't know, the Democratic Party from the United States. It's just too big. It's too many people. I mean, and Hezbollah isn't just a political party, right? I mean, it's a cultural movement. They have schools, hospitals, clinics. You know, they are a government in the same way that Hamas is and was a government in Gaza. I guess the thing is this, what is the purpose of these negotiations? I mean, I know nothing will come of them really, yeah. but why are they, you know, I mean, presumably the powers that be feel that, like Rubio, they feel like something, there's a reason they're doing this. I just can't figure out what it is.
Well, I think part of it is that Iran made the point of saying Israel is party to the conflict. They basically saying, look, there's no deal with us. We're not even going to negotiate with you as long as Israel is carrying out mass murder on an epic scale. I mean, they murdered like 300 people in one day. I think it was like a couple of days ago. And so the U.S. can get nothing accomplished while this thing is taking place. The problem is the government is not an honest reflection of the public, if that makes sense. Hmm. Because as you pointed out, a large part of the public supports Hezbollah in this case. Mm-hmm. It's a divided government in the most divided sense of the term government. But the U.S. has been pushing the government to go after Hezbollah, which is effectively a civil war.
Right.
And so it's like, you know, this government is not necessarily an honest reflection of Lebanon in the clearest terms of the word, sense of the word. Everybody that are on the ground in Lebanon point out the level of anger that's in the population itself. There's belief that Hezbollah may take it over. And there's even questions of why it hasn't up to this point. But the truth of the matter is, yeah, they're trying to get this veneer of a deal done with full knowledge that Hezbollah is never going to go for this idea of giving up their weapons. Why would they?
It has. And by the way, parenthetically, you know, the strength of Hezbollah and the fact that we're having this conversation and that they're still the dominant force in Lebanon,
yes,
serves as a potent reminder that you can't kill yourself your way to a solution the way the Israelis and the Americans think. I mean, they had this breathtaking espionage success with the pager attacks against right. Hezbollah's leaders. It's just absolutely brutal. And in the long run, it just doesn't make any fucking difference.
Yeah. I mean, you ended up killing kids, injuring random people. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with Hezbollah at all. I mean, it's outrageous. You can't kill your way to a solution. I think it's that.
So I guess, I think if I were the leaders of Hezbollah, I would be loath to take over the Lebanese government because then Lebanon faces Talibanization, right? Total isolation from the international community, delegitimization. I think it's useful to Hezbollah to have a Lebanese government that is not them. And it's like they can sort of swim in the, as fish through the ocean of the people, like a right. classic, you know, in the words of Che Guevara, as opposed to needing to sort of have the window dressing of, you know, governance, and not to mention, you know, it's going to delegitimize them and make them less militant. And what's the purpose of a militant Islamist organization if you're not militant? I think they might feel compelled to do that at some point, but I don't think it would be their first choice.
What's wild to me is that the U.S. maintains a veneer of legitimacy at all.
Oh, God. I mean, true.
Like, that's mind-blowing to me. Like, when, whatever people think of Hezbollah, the death toll that the United States has inflicted on the globe is dramatically and radically higher than anything Hezbollah has done. And let's be honest, Hezbollah is a response. It's not like Hezbollah just came out of nowhere. It was a response right. to Israel's attacks on Lebanon with the idea that the Lebanese government wasn't necessarily doing its job in defending the state. And so I understand. I feel you. We'll see. We'll see what these negotiations come up with. And we'll see, because there are a few unanswered questions, especially in the context of how fervent Iran is in, let's say, setting their objectives with mm-hmm. the Middle East.
Let's leave that there, because we have a busy news day and we have the good Baal professor coming on. Okay, so let's race through a few questions and we'll get to our next story. Sean Lewis, what do you guys think about the 10 scientists linked to the nuclear program that have turned up dead or missing recently?
Interesting. I don't know what to think about that. It was bizarre. They were saying a ton of nuclear scientists ended up dead.
Yeah, it's one of those stories. I go into wait and see mode for things like this. Okay, so there's a question for the professor. We'll get to that later. Any questions, Jamal could get a Rumble channel and then just automatically join his show to deprogram as you do with the PMI show. Yes, there is. That's what we need. Offline, you need to coordinate with Robbie to take care of that.
I will do. Yeah.
Flanderina, what was with Hegseth's repeated emphasis on how young our Navy decision makers are? Is that supposed to be a threat or a brag?
Wait, I don't remember this comment.
So I don't remember Hegseth, it either.
Okay, so Hegseth made a comment about military leadership being young.
Yeah, I think it's a brag. I mean, you know, he's a young guy, and I think it's this whole, like, we're young and we're virile and we're not a bunch of old men who are afraid to fight wars. Not like us guys, you know. Like it's a flex.
Is that even a flex? I mean, that's not a positive.
Well, I mean, it's neither negative or positive. I don't care if my political leadership is or military leadership is young or old. I just want them to be smart and effective. I don't think it makes any difference. Manchild, thanks for the dollar. Hey, fellas, is the U.S. the best arbiter of peace between Israel and Lebanon in this day and age? Well, JT kind of addressed that. Why did Lebanon demand a more neutral ground?
Because Lebanon is not a neutral country. like the lead, look, man, look at some of the decisions that the leadership of Lebanese have made. And look at what meaning they often are diametrically opposed to Hezbollah. Hezbollah has even put out comments saying, hey, we want the Lebanese government to work with us to push back the threat of Israel. And the Lebanese government won't do it.
Right. Let's move to the gay story. We have to talk about it. Adam 2. Wow, fake gays. Life is getting far more complicated to even attempt to understand these trends and new ideas. Was life always as disturbing, but it wasn't for the internet, we wouldn't have known? Yeah, and before that, the 24/7 news cycle also made things crazy. I'm old enough to remember when the news was something you got out of a newspaper and the evening news at 6:30 p.m. And until 6:30 p.m., you didn't really know if anything was going on.
Right.
So as long as an air raid siren hadn't gone off, you figured you're probably pretty much okay. So let's talk about this story. So basically, there's these immigration fixers in the UK, and they're charging up to £7,000 in order to process their Pakistani and Bangladeshi applicants for residency in the UK. And so they're applying for political asylum, and they're basically telling them, the easiest way is to pretend that you're gay, and we'll help you do that. They literally will even get a person to attest that they've had sex with you, homosexual sex with you. And they said, this is the best part. They said, nobody checks to see if you're gay, right? Like, if you claim that you're being, you need political asylum because your politics are in opposition to, say, the Bangladeshi governments and that you're being oppressed, they'll check that, or they'll try to check that. They will, but if you're like, I like other dudes, and that's how it is, and they're like, oh yeah, okay, I'm not looking into that. It is kind of hilarious. Look, I'll tell a story. So, Scott Stantis and I have talked many times on DMZ about like the wokeification of the Pulitzer Prizes, and. Uh-huh. We noticed over the years, in the last 10 years or so, that basically they're very clear about we want to give as many of these as possible to people of color, people who are historically disadvantaged, blah, 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 blah. But, the names are becoming more and more obscure. And Scott and I, as old white guys, are like, I would say, I think I need to come out as trans. I don't have to do anything these days to be trans. I don't have to, I don't have to put on lipstick. I don't have to cut off my parts. I can just say, I can be exactly the same person. I can just say I'm Kadena now or whatever. I'm transitioning. We're both convinced that if I did that, I would go up to the top of the pile at prize time, because it would be like, oh, that's super interesting. He's transitioning. And, and this kind of reminds me of that. The only reason I haven't done it, I love the prank aspect of it because it deserves to be pranked, but it's sort of like insulting to real trans people, right? So I'm so like, funny. Okay, I'm not going to take the piss on them.
God, it's funny. I don't know if you saw this weightlifter. There was this weightlifter who was, he was protesting this idea that people can just declare themselves trans. And he has full beard.
Right. I saw this guy.
I'm
like, what's trans about you? Nothing except just the word trans.
Yeah. He comes out, I'm a woman from here on out. And here's me bench pressing 600 pounds. Oh, shit. Here's me bench pressing 600 pounds. And it's like, what are you going to say to him? That the only thing a person has to do is declare themselves trans.
Yeah, so it's like, so this is kind of like that, right? And I also have someone who I'm close to who recently kind of like had a hard time getting into college. And so he checked the trans box, and I'll never know if he got in because he checked that box. Again, they don't check, right?
Imagine them saying, so Bob Ramunas. Yes, Bob Ramunas. And you're just lying.
Right.
And like you point out, who's going to check with Bob? How do you know Bob can exist?
Right. And it's kind of like, I don't even know what to make of it. In one sense, it exposes some of the silliness of identity politics.
Yes.
in another sense, it also is like people kind of getting into, it's like, I don't know. It's like sitting in the,
so corrupt.
It's corrupt. It's like, yeah, it's sort of like, I remember I broke my wrist about a year ago. And I was in a cast. And so when I got on the plane, I realized, oh, I'm like that guy who gets to go early on board the flight, because I really do need the help, because I could not get my luggage up onto the overhead, right, for about 3-4 months. And so I went on early. And I'm like thinking, you know, any asshole could just say, like, hey, I need to board early. I mean, I didn't. As soon as I was better, I stopped doing that. But I was like, there's all these people who do that. It's like the emotional support pets that people have, you know, they don't want to pay for their cat or whatever to be $150 on the plane. And by the way, it shouldn't be $150. It's ridiculous.
It's a poor animal.
It's animals like the size of a lunchbox, right? I mean, right. It slides under the seat. It's like, anyway, so they're like, oh, that's my emotional support kitty. Mm-hmm. And like, remember there was the emotional support peacock at LaGuardia? Because he doesn't travel without that. That may have been JFK. It was a magnificent peacock, I have to say. It would be my privilege to fly next to it.
Right. Right. Emotional support peacock. I mean, look, man, the moment that an incentive is created, like, I mean, it is, yes, it's corrupt. And yes, this idea that you kind of depend upon goodwill, like just an honest engagement with something. And so you don't necessarily abuse something. But let's
on the train, I take the senior discount. You're supposed to be 65. I'm 62. Fuck it. I'm taking it. Ask me for ID. Prove I'm not 65.
Exactly. I guess that's my point, right? Yeah. An incentive is created. Okay, somebody wants to get into the country. Oh, hey, if you're gay, you can get in.
Right. And then, of course, that prompts the question, right? Not begs the question, prompts the question that, like, you know, what are the criteria that we're using to let people in? I mean, literally, joking aside, I mean, real asylum seekers could literally be found out and killed because they were unable to get out. But meanwhile, if you were, you know, gay, even really gay, but you wouldn't have been killed. You know what I mean? Like a communist dissident in Bangladesh, and I know some people like that, literally, you know, they're in real jeopardy. And then, I mean, the system's fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they're looking at it as if you're in a Muslim country and you're gay or trans, you are at a higher risk for death. I guess that's the way to look at it. But as you point out, there are other people who are, in a political sense, who are just as much, if not more, jeopardy. And it's like the criteria that they're effectively using is very wokish. That's a word. No, I feel you.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's corrupt. Rational act. If you can make it work, right?
Yeah. And of course, I couldn't resist the, you know, any rhyming headline, you know, fake and gay in the UK. All right. Well, okay. So moving on here, because we do have a lot to cover here. Okay, tariffs. You know, as a commie, I'm not generally very sympathetic to business. However, in this particular, I'm going to make an exception here. So, Trump, of course, imposed massive tariffs at the beginning of last year. Yes. And it turns out the Supreme Court, you know, kind of did what we all knew the Supreme Court would do and say, like, the president can't unilaterally impose tariffs. And so, there's certain classifications of tariffs that are worth a total of about $175 billion that the U.S. federal government has collected. So to acquiesce with the Supreme Court ruling, and I will give them credit for this, Customs and Border Protection is opening up a web portal called CAPE, Consolidated Administration and Processing of Entries, catchy as always, so that businesses who had to pay these can apply for a refund. However, it's extremely complicated. The burden of proof is on the, and you know what this is also? This is, they know that the vast majority of businesses will not apply,
right?
And they'll get to keep the money. This is sort of like when business, remember you'd get like you'd buy something like 20 years ago, like at you know, Home Depot, and it would be like, oh, you know, you send in the coupon and you get the $20 rebate or whatever. And I was like, why don't they just fucking give you the $20 discount at the cash register? Because they know you're not going to do it. Or they might send you like the debit card. And they're even more sure. Most of those debit cards end up expiring, sitting in people's, you know, in people's drawers because they don't really manage them or pay attention to them because it's extra work. That's what this is. It seems to me that the government knows exactly how much they got from every business, and they should just turn it around and send it back without having to be asked for it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, like, this is kind of like the voting thing, right? Like when they were doing the Voting Rights Act stuff, and they would say, hey, man, well, the only thing you need is just to come down to get an ID, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, okay, yeah, but there was no issue with it prior. And the only reason you're doing that is because you know there's going to be a percentage of people who just don't do it. And so you're able to basically get something for nothing. So in this case, you have the U.S. government, Trump, doing something deeply illegal. It was understood to be illegal when Donald Trump was doing it. And nobody
said it. Predictably illegal.
Yeah. You noticed what the Supreme Court had to do, or at the very least, ideally, what they were going to do if they attended to any notion of law at all. And it's exactly what they did. And in this very specific case, Donald Trump, who claimed that he had $17 trillion or $20 trillion in tariffs or whatever the hell he was talking about, ends up being $173 billion. Not a small sum of money, certainly not $1 trillion, right? The rub is that those businesses most likely increase the cost to us.
Exactly.
Meaning, what about
us? Where's your refund? Where's my refund?
Where's my refund? Like, you think of all the things that you bought over the course of time for those tariffs. And sure, you could say that might have been $200, $300. That's $300 that I would prefer to have in my bank account as opposed to not as a result of illegal policy.
But this is a windfall profit for the companies that managed to extract their rebate from the government.
Yes. Because how much ever they increase, let's say Amazon, do you remember Amazon put a thing on saying the cost has been increased by this much because of the tariffs?
Yes.
Basically. Yes. Like you're trying to make it clear.
Should we call up Jeff Bezos and say, hey, Jeffy, we need our money back. I don't think we're gonna get very far with
that. But no, you're absolutely right. The government knows that X number of people are not going to do this.
Speaking of which, and then we'll bring in Dr. Fleming to talk about this, to talk about the Ball story. There is also news that the Trump administration quietly killed this initiative to try to make paying taxes easier. So I'm a dual citizen of U.S. and France, right? So in the French tax, France is one of many countries that does everything they can to make tax, your income tax, a less heinous experience. So you receive a form that's pre-filled out. Like the government knows how much you earned, right? So they literally just have, they send it all out. And it's like, if you agree with this, sign it and send us what you owe, the end. 99% of the time, it's exactly right. But if there's a modification, something they got wrong, then you put that in. There was an initiative afoot in the IRS to do the same thing here. But, you know, obviously H&R Block and all the other tax prep companies didn't want that to happen. And Republicans in Congress didn't want it to happen because they want us to hate paying taxes. So it's the same sort of thing where, I mean, I think we need a constitutional amendment that the government should have to try to make bureaucracy as simple as technologically possible for the American people and for businesses here.
Agree. But that requires public will. That's the rub.
Right.
Like, it's what, like,
and a more functioning political system.
And a more functioning political system. Unless the government is terrified of the population, then they don't really care. There needs to be a consequence.
Couldn't agree more. All right. Shall we bring in Dr. Fleming? Let's go ahead and do that. Dr. Dan Fleming, thank you so much for joining us. Daniel E. Fleming is the Edelman Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at the Skirball Department at New York University, a leading biblical scholar and a Syriologist. He earned his PhD from Harvard in 1990. He's taught at NYU after that. His research explores the Hebrew Bible, in its ancient Near Eastern context, with special focus on second millennium Syria, including the sites of Mari and Imar. He's the author of several influential books on early collective governance, Imar rituals, and the interplay between Israel and its neighbors. And the reason we're bringing you in, Dr. Fleming, is to talk about something that is not usually in the news, the Canaanite god Baal. Baal is, I remember Baal from reading my Bible. He's kind of like, you know, Yahweh's competitor in the Old Testament, and like he's the other guy. But he suddenly popped up in these Iran protests, where the the pro-government protests have effigies of Baal, you know, adorned with Stars of David and Trump and Jeffrey Epstein pictures, being burned and destroyed. And they've turned up in these Lego Iran propaganda videos, conflating the Statue of Liberty with Baal. What do you make of all this? What are we to make of all this? What's going on?
So you brought me in not as an expert in any of this new stuff. So I have no idea. Like what, but I mean, what I know about is the actual ancient stuff.
Great. Well, tell us that. Please tell us who is and was Baal.
I mean, I'll try to bridge a little bit between the actual thing and what people seem to be doing with it. Which is on one hand, the name Baal simply means Lord. And so it's a perfectly good title for God. It's a great title for a God in a world that had lots of them. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of gods who were called Baal, in whatever like exact form. And So
he's not a specific. So he's not necessarily a specific god.
Yes, yeah. It's not one thing.
That's right. So I mean, there are gods going back, you know, a couple thousand years before the Bible that had that title. There are two particular bad guys that ended up being potential competitors for the god of the Bible and the people of the Bible. One is just the local storm god, who had names that varied from something like Hadu to Hadad, which is at Damascus. They would have called him that. And he's the storm god. And so he had a kind of special right to the title of Baal. And in the area around Israel, you know, before the Bible even was starting to be written, if you said Baal, the odds are you meant the storm god. Who was a very powerful sort of young warrior god type in a world that had lots of gods. And then the other like bad guy that has the same title, but in a different related language, is that the head god of Babylon, whose name was Marduk, was also called Baal in the actual pronunciation that's slightly different from Baal. So when the people of Judah, Jerusalem was destroyed, the kingdoms of Israel and Judah came to an end, the Babylonian Empire took over, and Babylon became like the great bad guy, then the title was attached to the lead god of Babylon. But it's a different god, but it somehow, like, it's a good question, like, which name they were thinking of when they used the title. But the one other piece of this, I suppose, is that, you know, the Bible is a, like a library, and it's almost like Wikipedia or something. And it kept getting worked on. And so it's not as if it has one author and in one moment. And so in the Bible itself, there's a kind of process where when you want to say that the people of the Bible have gone astray, then you say, well, they've worshiped other gods, and the leading god that, or name of a god that they're supposed to worship is Baal. So that's where you get what's happening today, right? That if people go to the Bible, and in this case, like the Hebrew Bible, Christian Old Testament, and they think like, who is the chief bad guy God? Then that's the name that's at the top of the list.
And was there anything, so the Canaanite version of this storm god, what were the characteristics that were attributed to Baal?
I mean, one of the funny things is there's a psalm in the Bible, Psalm 29, that just it's a hymn to Yahweh, the God of Israel, and it just says like how great Yahweh is, and Yahweh thunders, and the mountains shake, and the lightning bolts come down. And there are scholars who have said that this was originally a hymn to Baal, the storm god Baal, and that pretty much the you just substitute in the name Yahweh, and they've co-opted the storm god. So one way to say what the characteristics would be is to look at that psalm. I mean, it's a god of the storm who brings rain. When rain doesn't come, then he's responsible for drought and famine. He's a young warrior type who's powerful. And then, of course, you know, it gets interesting when you're studying the history of the religion of the Bible, because the names of God in the Bible originate in more than one actual deity. So what happens is that, like in particular, there's the personal name of Israel's God, which is given four Hebrew letters, which would be YHWH, usually pronounced Yahweh. But then there's the name that's usually just translated as God. And that actually originated in another God, who was kind of an older, like, head of the group of gods, boss god sort of god. And so in this sort of scheme, the Canaanite storm god was the young warrior god underneath the sort of senior judge-like god.
So like Mars under Zeus kind of thing?
Yeah, actually, yeah, it works, right? I mean, because if you think, like, where do we go for thinking about a world with multiple gods, then Greece and Rome are like at least one familiar place. But in the world around Israel and Judah, everybody thought that way. And so, I mean, what then is really interesting about the title? So I don't know what familiarity your listeners have with religion, but one of the kind of classic ways to read the proper name of God, Yahweh, in the Bible, if you're reading Hebrew, is Adonai. And Adonai, actually, so Adon is equals Baal, like Baal. It is a synonym, a total full synonym. And the fascinating thing is that they were so determined to avoid using Baal Lord as a title that they said, okay, we'll use Adon. Like that works because it's not tied to a competing god.
Bad guy. Yeah. He was competing with their god, not because Baal was a bad guy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. No, that's exactly right. Like, there's no way, you got it. Like, I mean, there's no world in which Baal is a bad guy, like in their actual religion. But he was a competitor.
So he's not, I mean, so like in contemporary Christian circles, he's often kind of viewed as like a demon. Like Moloch, but that's not the origin.
No, not by any means. So yeah. I mean, what happens, of course, when you get, it's very interesting. It goes beyond. I studied more ancient things, but if you go into the period when Christianity was born and early Judaism, then you know what happens when everybody is used to a world with many gods, many powers, mm-hmm. and you'd think, okay, monotheism, get rid of them all. But the answer is actually no. Like, they don't get rid of them all. Instead, they have angels and demons, you know, like Dan Brown. Mm. So what happens is you get like angels who are all the deities who are in heaven and are allowed to be kind of good guys, more or less, and work for God. But the origin of those is like the mass of gods. But then it's interesting that in that world, you sort of then cut away then another set of gods, if you call it that, and you make them demons, like bad guys, and Baal becomes that. But this is all like really, like it's thousands of years after the origin of the title, and it's even hundreds of years after the use of the name. And there's nothing demonic about the name, even in the Bible, like it's, or the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible.
What was the main impetus towards monotheism as we understand it today, away from polytheism?
I know. I mean, this is a whole sort of scholarly enterprise to try to figure it out. I'll give you a slightly unexpected answer, maybe, which is empire. And the reason I go there, I'm not the only one, is that it appears that real kind of centralization of divine power begins not just in Israel and Judah, but also in Babylonia and Assyria, like which were the places of the first like really big empires in, you know, say the 700s, 600s BC. And so it appears that it didn't occur to people to try to organize all divine power under one head, like as if it were in one grand, you know, Washington, D.C. office or something, yeah. until like you had all that federalization of actual human power. And
was so,
I mean, it's more complicated, of course. But
So in a world of empire, right, which empires are basically small kingdoms, whatever, that are and cobbled together through conquest, usually. If kings and emperors rule by divine right, does it necessarily follow that an emperor would want like the biggest Trumpian god of them all, as opposed to just a, you know, the favor of a bunch of a whole hierarchy, like you know, like most Americans would be familiar with the Greek and ancient Greek and Roman gods.
I mean, there's different ways, kind of, to handle the existence of lots of gods, and I mean, that sort of famously among, I don't know, at least the students of religion, there's a guy named Akhenaten. I don't know if you've ever heard the name. Like, mm-hmm. It's an Egyptian king from the 14th century BCE, the New Kingdom, when they were kind of at their strongest as a kingdom. And this guy decided, okay, like, I'm getting rid of all the worship of all other gods. And he focused on sunlight, like not the sun god even, but the light as the only, it's the sort of the disk of the sun, the light of the sun. Ra was the sun itself, like so. What's interesting is that he wasn't doing it probably for empire building so much as to get rid of competing political powers, right? Like so one motivation for really centralizing down to one god is that you could have one temple and you, the king, could be the one who is responsible for contact between humanity and the gods. And you're the center of your people and your center of religious power and everything. One thing about that method is that when you die, it's over. Like it just evaporated after he died and the priests came back to power with their different temples. What happens in Mesopotamia where actually there's a little bit of a one god-izing, current there as well, is they thought, great, like keep the temples open, let everybody worship what they want, everybody's all in one system, but they're all under like the big god on the top, who's the god especially associated with the empire. And in some ways, like this was probably a more effective way to do it, like, sort of bring them all in under one big tent instead of trying to wipe them out. But of course, like this is what's fascinating about the Jewish people, that in having lost their political independence, then one like central crucial part of maintaining an identity that could somehow survive not having a political center was through religion. And so in a funny way, like the very lack of political power became a kind of way to define a monotheism that was detached from political power and almost became greater than anything. Like the brilliance of this solution is that you can lose every battle, you can be crushed, you can be, you know, scattered around the world, and you say, look, I mean, our God does what he wants,
and he works in mysterious ways.
Because if you tie your God to your political success, then when you lose, then your God loses.
Right. That's so interesting. Professor, I know you said this Iran stuff's not your specialty, but I'm going to ask you to speculate. Why do you think, first of all, why do you think the Iranians focused on this Baal thing? And then, like, by the way, can you address this idea, this conspiracy theory on the internet that this outbuilding on Jeffrey Epstein's island is a temple to Baal, just based on the architecture?
So I mean, you're asking me to talk about two topics that I don't know anything about. Like, so the Epstein thing, I know zero about, but I could tell you like what an actual Baal temple would have for architecture. I've never, you know, seen the thing that you're describing.
Oh, okay.
The Iranian thing is interesting, that in that presumably it's coming to them by way of the Quran and you know, Muslim religion. And this is way beyond my expertise, but in general, I mean, so the birth of Islam was a kind of intended course correction on Judaism and Christianity. Like, and so there's an embrace in many ways of the scriptures of Judaism and Christianity, of for sure the God of Judaism and Christianity, with an attempt to kind of refine the character of that God, to kind of take out any potential sort of complications. And so what's interesting is that it appears that Iranian Muslims are taking the idea that Baal is the chief antagonist to the real God from the Hebrew Bible.
Interesting.
I mean, and it's in a sense like totally logical, right? Like that it's and I don't know
stuff. It's like a god off.
And it's like it is a god off. Professor, we have a question, some questions from our viewers. Plasmatas is asking, does your area of study include Zoroastrianism or Mithraism? And could you speculate if Mithraism and Baal worship are two elements of modern Freemasonry?
That's pretty funny. It's only funny to me because the first answer is no, like my area doesn't go to Zoroastrianism, and certainly not to Freemasonry. But I mean, the thing I guess I'd say just as a starting point is that Zoroastrian religion is more or less like ancient Iranian religion, especially going back to the Persian Empire. And the reason it was such a powerful thing is because the Persian Empire was probably like the first really great empire, like durable. I mean, the Assyrian Empire would have been the first, but the Persian Empire was so much bigger. And so Zoroastrian religion is really not anchored in even the ideas that generated Baal worship. Like, it's not tied in any way to the stream of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's its own thing. And it's what stands out about it is that they have this idea that the powers, the great divine powers, were really split between good and evil. And in sometimes people say that the influence on, say, early Judaism and Christianity toward breaking up divine power into good and evil, as opposed to just them being out there responsible for everything in the world, that may have come from Zoroastrian thought, like a kind of influence of it. But if so, like the actual notion that there were evil power, that there was evil power and darkness in Zoroastrian thought, had nothing to do with Baal. Like that's a sort of mishmash, like of the two.
Well, speaking of connecting, another question from Arian Gordy, 1220. As a Hindu myself, I wonder if a connection between some of the ancient religions like Christianity or another theology might have existed 10,000 years ago. There seem to be many parallels to Hinduism.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, like what do we know about ancient religion? Like, so for one, if you want names, if you want descriptions, if you have to have writing and texts, although, I mean, there's people excavate what are identified as temples, and then there's art and objects that seem to suggest religion. And so if you're talking 10,000 years ago, year before writing, it's really hard to know how to make comparisons. But one thing that is true about South Asia is that they also start with a kind of baseline of lots of divine powers and you know, a sort of simple society with a lot of the same building block ingredients. It wouldn't be so surprising. One of the things when I'm teaching classes that have East Asian students, you know, sort of China, Japan, Korea, is that in Western Asia, there's a centrality to watching out for the dead, considering your ancestors a continuing part of your family, that is still more familiar to East Asian societies than, you know, to anybody else in some ways. And so this is not because there's some kind of direct influence of one side to the other, but they probably go back to really, really ancient just trends across Asia, and that people tended to treat family as a thing that went backward and forward in time before and after your own like existence. But overall, like I think there's no like line of influence or something like that. And partly I can't answer the person's question because we just don't know enough. But it's not surprising that there would be a lot of things in common.
Professor, really appreciate this. I found it fascinating. If nothing else, you've sold a book or two to me. I'm going to go online and buy one of your books. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back. I'm sure if it's not Baal, it'll be some other ancient day.
I can tell you range widely. So, and Jamari, I don't know anything about you, but thanks for hanging around. Like, why would you want to hear all this? So,
well, absolutely. I mean, I was fascinated by it. I mean, the religious thing is interesting in general, especially in the context of how it deals with today's world.
Well, I'll sign off and let you get on.
Thank you very much, Professor. Thanks for watching, and we'll be in touch. Thank you. That was Dr. Daniel E. Fleming. He's the Edelman Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at the Skirball Department at NYU. He's a leading biblical scholar and Assyriologist. He has a PhD from Harvard from 1990, and he has a special focus on Second Millennium Syria. I don't know. I did find it fascinating.
So the Bible is the first propaganda document.
Monotheism is tied to empire. That's cool.
That is very interesting. I mean, cause that means that there's a correlation between the religious elements and political elements, and it's kind of odd dovetail, if that's true.
Totally. That's interesting. I've got to bring Robbie on. Robbie, Hi. What did you think of all that?
I don't know. I mean, no, it was interesting. I did not know that Baal was a title, so that was something that new that I learned. Yeah, I guess this all just comes down to faith and what you believe, right? I mean, I'm always a fundamentalist Christian, and I believe what I believe. I believe that the Bible is the Word of God, is the perfect preserved Word of God, and it just comes down to faith at the end of the day.
Totally.
And, I mean, the Bible says, there are no other gods beside me. I am that I am. And so if you believe that, if you have these other gods, then that means either A, they're false, or B, even worse, they could be demons.
Well, that's for me where my faith fell apart as a teenager, was when I realized, when I read that there were other gods and other religions. And it's like, well, I was like, all these people believed that there, you know, Zarathustra or Zeus or whoever, that those were real, and they were real to them. So, like, how could it be that I, you know, I got it right and they got it wrong? Like, what are the odds of that? And right. And that's where,
sure. Well, that's where I mean, ultimately, that's the crust of it, right? And one thing, and I firmly believe this, like, the Roman and Greek gods are basically just the adaptations of the old Egyptian gods. I believe that they were real spiritual beings. I believe they were actual demons, that they did works, that they didn't know they did things. They had agency, and they still exist today. They just work in different ways. I think that's one of the reasons.
So what the professor, I mean, but what the professor said also, I thought was fascinating. I wanted your thoughts about this culturally. So Baal's not really a big deal to Muslims, right? So this is like, we talked about how the Iran propaganda videos, the Lego videos and the other ones, those are, a lot of it is the connection happens because the Iranians are talking to us in our language, toys, Legos, yeah, pop culture, diss tracks. And Baal is part of that, mm-hmm, right? Baal has resonance to anybody who's ever read the Old Testament in the United States.
Or watch Stargate SG-1.
Right.
So, I mean, that's how I know. I knew him as Stargate.
So this is about Iranians using our language to connect with us through propaganda, and I would argue very effectively, compared to, for example, the Chinese videos, you know, with like the Persian cat and all that, which I love, but they make really no sense to me at all. I don't think they connect to Americans in the same way.
Now, the Iranians definitely did a better job, honestly. And one thing that I'm going to give this to the mullahs in Iran for free. If you really want to take this up to the next level, lay off on Baal and look at Rimfan, whose old name was Moloch. Because the very first time that the word Jew is ever used in the Bible is in 1 Kings, if I remember right, and they were fighting the Jews. The Jews of Judea were fighting against Israel and Syria, because Syria allied with Israel to attack Judea, tried to conquer Jerusalem. That's the very first time that the word is used. And one of the recurring themes through this is that you pass your children through the fire. You pass your children through the fire in honor of your star god. Well, who's the star god? Rimfan, the star of David. It has nothing to do with David. It is the star of Rimfan. So if the Iranians really want to tie this back in to how devilish a religion Judaism is, that's all they got to do.
Robbie, do we have time for an ad or not? We have another story to cover, a couple of questions.
We better skip it.
All right. All right. Thanks, Robbie. Okay. So so there's a student, he's a dude, Amandla Thomas Johnson, was a PhD student studying in the U.S. back in September of 2024. He went to an anti-Israeli pro-Palestinian protest briefly in April of 2025 in retaliation. I sent Google what they call an administrative subpoena, which is not a real subpoena. It's bullshit. It's just something. It's a piece of paper that they write out. A real subpoena is issued by a judge. This was not asking Google to send his personal information. Google 10 years ago said, we will never turn over your data to the cops before first telling you the cops have asked for your data and giving you a chance to fight that with a lawyer or otherwise. This time they didn't do that. They just turned it right over. How much should we care about that?
I think we should care a big deal about it. I mean, well, two things. Google, whether you talk about Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, et cetera, these are American companies. And in the context of American companies, they're working hand in hand with the U.S. government. If you think I am being over the top on that, go back to a few years ago when Joe Biden was trying to create this kind of system of engaging these companies in order to get information on various Americans, or for that matter, shadow ban or block various Americans, depending on the content that they were putting out. We know that because they killed our network in general, but they were also going after these companies in order to either get information or get them to behave in a particular way. You should assume that if you're using one of these products, that you are effectively using something that is an extension of American imperialistic might in a propaganda sense. And so, yeah, I'm not shocked in the least that a company that was shadow banning, blocking, and passing off information to the Biden administration is doing the same thing under the Trump administration.
That's too good to add to. I'm going to leave that there. And let's take these questions. Manchild, that was fascinating. Is the Baal imagery a little too highbrow for us American goobers?
Yes.
Maybe, yes. Although Baal is very, very cool looking and wild looking.
Arian Forty,
thanks for the dollar. There's one truth and it has 1,000 names. Stay true to yourself and don't let religion divide us. Good, always a good idea. And Scott Cove, thanks for the fiber. Carlos Martinez would be a great guest to discuss Chinese socialism and their communist government. Okay, well, let's see if we can reach out.
Wait, real quick, what's the one truth?
Oh, I don't know. It's like,
I don't
have 2 minutes. Right? We have a minute and a half left, really?
Yeah.
That's the truth. The truth is we have a minute and a half left. Yeah. 100%. Oh, my God. Let's see. There were. We do need to talk about, Adam 2, Baal, Goyim, and Jewish versus Israelis. Please decipher that for us. Are we all Goyim for the Israelis, and why? Thank you. Yeah, all non-Jews are Goyim, right? There's a question. Sorry, we didn't get this as Frasmataz. I apologize. I didn't see it while I was talking to the professor. Can you do the guest to do a quick mention on Shia Islam? Does it have a Mithraic and Zoroastrian element, or was it simply to avoid taxation? I would talk to him again, so maybe we'll get him back. We can talk about these things. Anyway, thanks, everyone, for joining us. Much appreciate you. Really appreciated that discussion about Baal. We'll look out for Carlos Martinez, see what we can do there. Please like, follow, and share the show. The show always can use and appreciates your support. Stay tuned for TMI Show with Nuala Chan and myself coming up right now. And there will be no DMZ America podcast today due to a death in Scott's family. We hope you're having a great day. Have a great Thursday. See you tomorrow, Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Bye, Jamal.
Have a good one, guys. Thanks.
Bye.